All right, so the first condition is, with all of our heart, we return to Yahweh. Choosing, this is the second, to turn away from and removing accordingly the foreign, pagan, and worthless gods from among you. So Yahweh is saying here that not only do we need to change our direction to approach Him, we need to choose to turn away from and remove the influence of foreign, pagan, and worthless gods. The verb, chur, means electing of our own volition, forsaking, rejecting, getting rid of, bringing an end to while avoiding and abolishing. This is in the hiphol, imperative, active. All right, the hiphol, the subject is the actor, and it causes the object to participate in the action. So this is speaking to us. So we're the subject, we're the actor. And then that means that we influence and bring into the action the subject. Now, the subject here is false gods. Now, you'd think, now how in the world could he use the hiphol to describe in this case? Well, the reason is that, well, false gods can't do anything on their own. By us rejecting them, we diminish their influence in our lives and in the lives of others.
And that's all it takes.
That's all it takes. Yeah, that's really all it takes. So the hiphol says that if you act, there will be a benefit. There will be a direct consequence of your acting. The imperative is the principal voice of volition in Hebrew.
You know,
there are three of them, but the imperative is the dominant voice of volition. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know what the ancient Nikar is translated as disaster and calamity.
Yeah,
it's strange and alien.
There's foreign gods. Yeah, disastrous. Yeah, no question.
That should give you a clue.
Yeah, but chur here, this choosing to turn away and removing is the hiphol stem, which means that our actions will elicit a response based upon the action of the verb. The action of the verb is to remove and to turn away from. So if we remove and turn away from the false gods, they will be removed from our nature, from our lives, from influencing us. And the imperative is the voice of volition, which means that under the auspices of first will, of free will, this is our choice. We have that choice. God gave us that choice. We can embrace false gods, or we can reject them. It's our choice. Each choice has a consequence, but it's our choice. Free will. And then, as you said, Nekar means alien and valueless, incomprehensible and improper, the pretend in disguise, someone else's disastrous and ruinous, another person's mistaken and feigned pretense of strange gods. Man's made a lot of gods.
Yeah. And
called by a lot of different names. All equally false. And it's this notion that, well, they provide people with hope. Well, God's saying that they're valueless. False hope is counterproductive. It's disastrous and ruinous. So this notion that we shouldn't condemn them, that we should tolerate them, is mistaken. Because these are all feigned pretenses of gods made in man's image. So he wants us to turn away from and remove these foreign, pagan, and worthless gods from among us, from our midst. Then we get to the third.
He tells you who they are next.
Yeah. Well, he wants all of them removed, but he lists one in particular.
Yeah.
So he wants them all removed. That would be Lord, Jesus, Christ, Allah, Buddha. He wants them all removed.
Shiva.
Shiva. But there is one in particular that is the most troubling.
Yeah.
And that one is the one that he names by name. Ashtarts. In fact, he writes it in the plural. The Ashtarts. And it's Ha Ashtarts. So it's interesting that he, first of all, preceded the name with a definite article. Because you don't, I don't say the Kirk or the Scott.
No.
but I will speak of titles with a definite article. So by introducing the definite article here, we're dealing with a title. And the fact that it was written in the plural, there are a variety of titles. And so the Astartes are the queens of heaven, the mothers of God, and the virgins with child. Do you know any religion that claims that somebody is the queen of heaven, mother of God, and is the virgin with child?
I think it has to do with Roman Catholicism.
Yeah.
It came from Babylon.
Yeah, the basis of Christianity came right out of the pages of the Babylonian religion. No hiding it. No question about it.
No, nobody can fight that. Nobody can argue that point.
That point cannot be argued. That Astarte represents the queens of heaven, the mother of God, and the virgins with child, and that this is the principal connection between Babylon and Roman Catholicism. Anyway, it's Astarte. It's corrected from the errant Masoretic vowel pointing of Ashtoreth. And Astarte is the principal pagan mother earth goddess that was synchronized into the religions of the Sumerians, the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Egyptians.
Right.
The Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Phoenicians. In the Phoenicians, she was the Lady of Byblos, which means she was the Lady of the Bible. The Syrians, the Persians, the Indians, the Greeks, the dastardly Romans, the Carthaginians, the Cypriots, and of course the Christians. She's also known as Ishtar, the Star of Heaven, from which Easter got its name, Astarte, Isis, Aphrodite, Venus, India, Diana, and Mary. She is either the consort of or the daughter of the Lord, Baal, El, Ra, Osiris, Tammuz, Asher, Sen, Zeus, or Jupiter. Actually, you should say she is the consort, daughter, or mother.
Yeah. Well, when you have a repeating god every year, you can be
right.
Mother of life, too.
Yeah. It's a lot of incestuous interactions in the Parthenon of pagan gods.
Mm-hmm.
She was called the Queen of Heaven, which is affirmed in Yirmiyah Jeremiah. It's a passage that in a future program we're going to elaborate on. She was known principally as the Mother of God, the Virgin and Madonna with Child, the basis of Mary worship in Roman Catholicism. She was Lord of the Horns. The name itself is based on Ashar and Ashtara. This is revealing.
Yeah.
Her name means to become rich by increasing one's flock while taking a tithe.
That was good.
Can you say Christianity? Can you just say religion in general?
Yeah,
we're all going to take a tithe. Yeah, we're going to increase one's flock and take a tithe.
Pass the plan.
Okay. Whore of Babylon, indeed. Also, so now we're dealing with the next condition. And also, choose to fashion through unwavering preparation and confident determination, kun, your heart for Yahweh. All right, so kun, this is what he's asking us to do with our lev, just in case you didn't understand the full implications of heart. It means to elect to form, to confirm, and to develop. Under the auspices of free will, because this was influenced by the imperative mood, establish so as to be sure and enduring. Direct, appoint, and affirm. Prepare and trust. Be steadfast, standing firm, stable, secure, and upright. with regard to your heart. The Hiphil stem reveals that our influence of our heart causes it to respond in this way, while the imperative mood tells us that doing so should be our choice. While the active voice conveys that if you initiate this process, your heart will undergo these changes. So, with firmly fashioned, through unwavering preparation and confident determination. Does that sound like faith to you?
No.
That sound like a belief system to you?
They can't live together.
Does that sound like a leap into the darkness?
No.
How would you prepare your inner nature? How would you prepare with confident determination?
You study. You learn.
Study. Right.
Gemara.
Right. You shemar. You observe. You study. You learn. You contemplate. You come to understand. That's how you do it. So choose to firmly fashion, through unwavering preparation and confident determination, your heart for Yahweh. Not for Allah, not for Jesus, not for the Lord, for Yahweh.
Yeah, and it's never an emotional thing we're talking about, the heart, greeting card type of definition. We're talking about your fabric, your thinking, your being, you know.
Yeah. Well, the heart can serve to convey your source of emotions.
Decision. This is your abstract thing. I mean, not abstract things. These are things that they're concrete. We can trust.
Right. In the ancient world, when heart was used, it meant your inner being, mm-hmm. that which constitutes your most authentic nature and becomes the very fabric of your life. It's the place where that which is known, which is understood and accepted, serves to provide perspective. Guiding your thoughts and conduct, becoming the source of your emotions and motivations, mm-hmm. goals and ambitions, preferences and purpose, volition, judgment.
Yeah. Right.
On behalf of Yahweh, and work with Him. Expend considerable energy and intensity in association with Him, to serve with Him and engage with Him, cultivating that which grows and is productive with Him, while approaching Him exclusively. Him alone, by himself, apart from any others.
I think that refers back to the first tablet of stone, doesn't it?
Yep. Him exclusively. You can't embrace the Queen of Heaven. You can't be going down the wrong path. You can't choose to incorporate a Jesus or an Allah. It has to be Him exclusively. Then He will deliver you out of the hand and influence of the Pelishti, the foreign foes who invade the promised land, invoking fear while separating and terrorizing. Pelishti is to invade and to divide as an adversarial foreigner. It's transliterated Philistines. It's from Pelesh, which means to attack, to overrun, to attempt to occupy, to divide and to separate. Peleth, which is to wander away and flee, and Palash, to roll, turning over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
It's related to Palats, which means to terrorize and invoke instability and fear. It's a place of sorrow in Exodus 15:14. It's a place that a people and a nation vanquished by God in Psalm 108:10. Estranged from God in Joel 4:4. An enemy of Yisrael and David, actually Dod, and thus of God in 1 Samuel 17, chapter 17 through 22.
Also got wallow in the dirt and roll in the dust.
Yeah, and that's the first...
not a very good description.
Yeah, the first that I got is from Strong's, is where you found that. And that's where I got it initially, was from Strong's.
I'm sure I got it there,
too. Yeah, and I chose to ignore it. What I did here is, we need to realize that there are a lot of Hebrew words that at least aren't vowel-pointed such that they appear in the lexicons that are devoted to the words that the Masoretes marked to be in the Torah. And the verb which underlies peleste is a great example of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to go to the old interweb to look at what is the actionable base, the verbal base for peleste. And that's where I found the meaning. And there's almost unanimity of affirmation here. That peleste is based on peleth, and the verb means to wonder, to attack, to overrun, to attempt to occupy, to divide and separate.
Well, that's certainly
and,
I mean,
and so bad. the Pelish are foreigners who attack, who attempt to occupy, divide and separate the promised land. So anyway, that's the best definition we have. But we're going to focus here in a moment on, in fact, not in a moment, but in another program on who they are. So what I'd like to do is, since these were interesting conditions, is let's go through these conditions as well as the benefit one more time. And then in a future program, we're going to dial down into probably spending a better part of a program on who, what is represented by the Estart. And why the plural and why the definite article? And what does Yahweh have to say specifically about the Estart? And we're going to also drill down, and probably first drill down on the Philistine, the Philistines.
Well, that's who they are today.
Yeah, who they are, what they represent, why God is willing to deliver us from them. So before we examine the villains in the story, Astarte and the Philistine, let's consider the thrust of Shamuel's message. And there's no better place to begin than by appreciating the implications of his name, as we began earlier, Shamuel. He listens to God. Isn't that where we all should begin?
Absolutely.
An appreciation for the message associated by or associated with Shamuel and his name makes what Shamuel has to say relevant and true, applicable and dependable. After listening to Yahweh, Shamuel shared what God had to say. And, you know, that's the reason why I would say that, you know, if somebody wants to claim that Shamuel means that Shem is name, and so it's name of God, and they want to say, all right, and so it's name of God, and he spoke to the God named Yahweh, I don't have a problem with that. But I always find that context is the best way to properly translate everything.
Right.
And the context of the entire book of Shamuel is of Shamuel listening to Yahweh and then sharing with the house of Yisrael what Yahweh had to say.
Yeah, he does what we don't do, we were never taught to do about prayer. He actually asks a question, and then he shuts up and listens.
Correct.
He doesn't, you know, give me.
Right, and, you know, and he will start off by saying, you know, this is my take on this. And then he'll go to Yahweh and say, all right, this is my take on this, but, I want to know your perspective.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that is troubling to God is that Christians in particular and Muslims, absolutely, they're praying all the time. Why do you think that you as a Christian or as a Muslim have something to say that's going to be interesting to God? Don't you think just for a moment that what God has to say might be more useful, might be more pertinent?
Yeah, well, everybody wants to teach the teacher, you know.
Right. So, you know, why would you go and yabber away at the creator of the universe as opposed to listening to the creator of the universe? Wouldn't you want to listen to him and then respond?
You would think.
And, you know, and one of the things, too, and this is the point that Yosha made, why in the world are you asking him for all this stuff?
When you got the Torah right across the street.
Right, right. You know, the vast preponderance of this, you don't need to listen. You don't need to ask. He's already provided the answer. And there's nothing you can do to irritate somebody more than asking them a question that they have already provided the answer. It shows that you're selfish because you haven't taken the time to read the answer. The answer is there. Read it. You want to know God's will for your life? Read the Torah. That's just the right. He tells you what his will is. So why in the hell are you asking him?
I've met a lot of people. I pray every day that he'll tell me what his will for me is.
Yeah.
But you want to we'll get a job.
I'll guarantee you that's one thing I've never asked him. In fact, I don't pray to him.
No.
I listen to him. I listen to him and I respond to him. That's it.
Worked for Samuel.
Yeah, it works for Samuel. It works for me. Okay, recognizing that we are now party to God's thoughts, let's consider the message the prophet conveyed one statement at a time. First, Samuel consistently spoke to, actually promised, and habitually declared a message on behalf of Almighty God, recognizing the unfolding and ongoing consequence of his statements throughout the whole of time, always claiming and genuinely professing to the entirety of the household, family, and home, the lineage and successive generations, which would be related by birth of Yisrael, of those individuals who engage and endure with God, who participate and strive with God, and who are empowered by the Almighty, as did Sarah. That's the opening statement. So as a result of listening to what Yahweh had to say, Samuel was in a position to accurately convey God's message, something he did with great regularity. He listened and he spoke consistently and continually. It's a message for all of us. Our testimony can be similarly relevant, equally reliable, so long as we observe this prophet's pattern. You know, we have a good friend, Larry, who typically joins us on this program. Larry has a Facebook site, which he entertains lots of folks on. And his pattern is exactly the same as Samuel. He shares what Yahweh said, period.
Exactly.
He doesn't care if you like it or don't
care
like
or lump it.
Yeah, like it or lump it. Doesn't care. But he knows that what he's saying is true because all he does is counters everything that is brought up with Yahweh's testimony.
Yeah, exactly. He quotes, this is exactly what Yahweh said about this.
Yeah.
It's the best translation you can find.
Yep.
There.
So while we mentioned this before, Yisrael is sometimes deployed to depict a nation at odds with Yah. The name was conceived to represent God's chosen people. Yisrael is his family with whom he has a covenant. This is why Sarah's name, who is Abraham's wife and Yishak's mother, is found between Ish, individual, and El, God, in Israel. And fortunately for all of us, there is an open invitation to become part of Yisrael and Yah's covenant. But Kirk, Scott, that invitation is only found in one place.
Right. The Torah.
It's only found in the opening book of the Torah. You know, God begins this whole thing by handing us an engraved invitation. But if you reject the Torah, you won't find it. Now, for those who are listening, who are currently unaware of the five conditions and five benefits of participating in the covenant, if you have been directed to this program, but you're unaware of the specific nature of Yahweh's seven invitations to meet each year, then this isn't really the right program for you to be listening to. You'd be much better off if you would go now to the first two volumes of Yada Yah. You'll find it at yadayah.com. Do it now. First things first.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to yadayah.com, the first thing that's going to happen is you're going to be introduced to who Yahweh is, and you're going to engage him in the creation of the universe and his authorship of life. It's a fascinating revelation. By the time you're through with the first four or five chapters that correctly reveal what Yahweh had to say about creation, and that compare that to science. If you are not convinced that the author of that creation account is in fact Almighty God, then you are either irrational or close-minded.
Mm-hmm. It's the only explanation.
Yeah, because the proof that is provided that the author of the creation account, the creator himself, is overwhelming. And it will, and there's no reason to go through the details now.
No.
But the proof is literally overwhelming. And then it moves from there to several chapters devoted. It moves from there to a chapter devoted to life in Eden, where we learned that there was no religion, no politics, no government authority, no militaries. That it was just Yahweh having an enjoyable and personal relationship with Adam, and then with Adam and Chawa. And so we consider the nature of the relationship Yahweh had with Adam and Chawa in the Garden of Eden, because that not only represents where we are headed in year 6000, Yah, 2033, Yah was going to return the entire earth to the conditions found in the Garden of Eden. So if you don't like the conditions, if you don't like what occurred in the Garden of Eden, you're not going to like eternity with Yahweh.
No point going through this, no.
Yeah, no point in going through this. You know, if you prefer religion, you won't find religion in the garden. If you love politics, you won't find politics in the garden. If you love patriotism, you're not going to find patriotism in the garden. There are no pledges of allegiance.
Can't even give a tithe.
No, can't even give a tithe. Yep. So that's the nature of the next two chapters. And then it's followed by a chapter on the flood with Noah, so that you understand why God reset humankind, at least humankind with the Nesama, in that particular place and time. And you come to understand the scientific basis for the flood, which is really insightful.
Staggering.
It's staggering. Yeah, it's just like the creation account. You cannot read it with an open mind and walk away not recognizing that this was that the author of this story is the Creator God of the universe.
Yeah, he saw it happen.
Yeah, and what you find is that covenant is identical to the covenant that he reveals next, and that's the next three chapters of Yada Yah explains the covenant as it was established with Abraham. Because there's only one covenant, and the terms and conditions that Abraham was asked to accept are the same for us. And the benefits that were offered to Abraham are the same for us. Five benefits, five conditions. And if you don't know what those are, well, I could summarize them here for you, and as Kirk could do, Scott could do.
Sure.
And that we know and have accepted. Out of the context of the whole discussion, without a very thoughtful presentation of them, I'm not sure they would do you a lot of good.
No.
But at least so that there is some semblance of understanding here. The five conditions for participating in the covenant are as follows. First, that we walk away from our country, from our society. That we disassociate from everything associated with Babylon. The whore of Babylon, who is Astarte, mother of God, queen of heaven.
Right.
That we disassociate from Bibles, which is the being with the Lord Baal and with confusion. That we walk away from religion, from governance, from politics. We disassociate from these things. In fact, the first condition of the covenant, which is the first thing that Abram had to do before he and Yahweh engaged in a relationship, happens to be the very thing that Shemuel is laying out right here. It doesn't change. That's the first requirement. It's the prerequisite for engaging in a relationship with God, is walking away from these human institutions. The second is to walk to God and become perfect. And there's only one way, only one path that Yahweh has provided. And that path is through his invitations to meet. Seven steps. Six steps that lead to the final definition, the destination. And then he says to trust and rely on him. Which is exactly what is found in Shamuel's conditions, to trust and rely upon him. The fourth condition is to closely examine and carefully consider the instructions and conditions associated with the relationship agreement, which you can only do by reading the Torah. And finally, if you're a man, to be circumcised and to circumcise your children so that we all share the sign of the covenant. The benefits, then, is that we become immortal, we're perfected, we're adopted into Yahweh's family. We are enriched and we are empowered. These are the benefits of the first four Moed Mikre, all four of which were fulfilled by Yahusha in year 4000 Yah, 33 CE, on our Roman Catholic pagan calendars.